This is Arena on RTE Radio 1.
You are very welcome along to what, confusingly for me anyway, is Wednesday night's Arena. Thank you very much to Christine Leach and Cathy Rose O'Brien for taking such good care of the programme over the last few nights. Tonight, the director and one of the stars of a new film, Trad, a drama following a group of travelling musicians. I'm also going to be joined by Grammy winner, composer and choral superstar Eric Whittaker ahead of his upcoming night at the National Concert Hall. And we'll be talking to the cast of a play set in a retirement home in the Mojave Desert, Elysium, Nevada. You can text us on 51551. Our WhatsApp is 0870 3232. And you can email arena@rte.ie. Tonight we get started with this. Trad is a new Irish drama written, directed and produced by Lance Daly. It follows Shona McAnally, a gifted young fiddle player from Donegal, played by newcomer Megan Nguinla, as she joins a group of travelling musicians. She navigates love, freedom and the pull between tradition and modern life. Megan Nguinla makes her acting debut in Trad, and her own fiddle playing roots gives the film its emotional heart and celebrates Irish music and culture. I'm delighted to welcome to studio both Lance and Megan. Lance, first of all, tell us about Trad and what is the inspiration behind the film, and why did you want to tell this story?
Well, I had two things in mind, really, making the film. One was looking at young people playing Irish music, which I've always thought was really interesting, you know, how young people sort of bring a new energy to it and they sort of try to change it, but it inevitably changes them. And then just the idea about the session, you know, and what the session is and what the session can be and how I'd never really seen it in a movie. And I was sort of tickled by the idea of making a movie where the climax of the movie was just a big session with all the characters from the story there and sort of understand everything between them. But now they're just playing music together and, you know, and there's no dialogue. And I sort of thought about it like a big action climax, but in music, you know. And so it was really about making a film to get to that point, you know, and to try and sort of celebrate that. And I just thought it was weird that we hadn't had a movie about traditional Irish music.
Because it's the sort of thing you find in documentary all the time, but rarely in fiction. Fiction tends not to deal with it.
No, and that was one of the tricks when we started designing posters and stuff for it. It was, people kept saying, oh, it just seems like a documentary, feels like a documentary, and it's called Trad. So we're like, we want, you know, people to know it's a story, it's a movie about, it's a road movie, you know, coming of age road movie. So pretty far away from documentary, and really just trying to, you know, I was trying to think about what, if trad music was cinema, you know, what does that look like? And sort of the spirit of Irish music, and to, you know, to encode that into a movie, like how do you tell a story that feels like the music?
So once you've made the idea to make this film, you need a young, gifted musician to play Shona. So how do you go about finding that musician?
Well, I've a few friends who have been in Irish music all their lives. And so I started with them and asking for, you know, just following the leads, because everybody in trad music knows each other. So, and Edwina Gukian, who's going to choreograph some of the Shanos dancing in it, suggested Megan as a potential candidate. And I found her graduate video from the University of Limerick on YouTube and actually really liked her playing, first of all. And then we ended up chasing around the country for months because when we first reached out, she sort of said, oh, that's never going to happen. They're never going to put me in a movie. So she's actually turned out she was kind of tricky to get in for an audition. And
yeah, I've heard about this, Megan, that you spent quite a while not returning Lance's calls. Tell me about that from your side. What was that like?
We met up and he gave me a script. And at the beginning, I was like, yeah, that's class. And he told me just to give him text him whenever I finish the script, but I just never got around to finishing it, so I never text him back. But I was planning on it, but it just never happened. And then he put out like a national call for people to audition for the film, and then I got asked to go in, and then we got a wee bit of a reunion from our last meeting. But yeah, I did get back to him eventually.
You're a very talented musician. We're going to ask you to play something for us in a little while. But was it the idea of the promotion of traditional music in this film that made you think, yeah, this might be something to do?
Well, there's nothing really like it anywhere else. And it's great. You know, there's a lot of documentaries about Irish music and Irish musicians and stuff, but usually in films, if there's any bit of Irish music, it's the background and they play some kind of really terrible tune in the background of all these live people talking, or it's very much like an advert for like Culture Ireland sometimes with how they promote Irish music and different things. But yeah, I just thought it was a really cool idea and I said, why not?
So. Okay, we're going to take a moment from the film here. This is at the family home in Donegal, and Valerie McAnally is trying to get her two children to try out new clothes for the upcoming fla. It's Sarah Green as Valerie, Megan Nguinle as Shona, Dallin Wood as her brother Mickey, and Peter Coonan as Des McAnally.
Try it on and I'll tell you where your helmet is.
No thanks, I'll find it myself.
Michael's dressing up.
And look at the fucking head, and he's miserable.
Presentation, Shona. The family reflects the school and vice versa. We're there to win.
You're not just blow one of the judges like last year.
Jesus, will you just try the fucking dress? Without the jeans.
This is all you're getting.
What about the shoes? See it all together at least. Colin, Jess.
So where's the helmet?
How the fuck would I know?
Stay.
Do you want this pointy shoe up your hole, Muppet?
Okay, so Megan, tell me about how daunting the idea was for you as somebody who hadn't acted before to go in front of camera and to embody an entirely different character who wasn't you.
It was probably the most frightening thing I've ever had to do. I had to go up to Dublin like once or twice a week, most times to prepare for it, because I had told Lance how I felt about it and how I wasn't really comfortable doing it. Even when I did the audition, I started crying and had to leave the room. But yeah, so I'd go to Dublin and he kind of just helped me out and prepared me for just learning lines and talking in front of a camera, how to act at all. Yeah. But it was really scary. But once I got over it, I just did it. You know, you just kind of got on with it.
Lance,
like anything.
What was that like as a director? Was that something you were looking for in an actor? Somebody who embodied that kind of not actorish sense, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, I've made films with non-actors or first-time actors before and with young people before, and I'm always interested in, I think the person who's saying don't look at me is always the one you want to look at it, you're more interested in. So the reluctance is it does add to it, but then, you know, it was a while of Megan was having panic attacks and stuff when we first put the camera in front of her, and so there was a bit of aversion therapy where I thought we just need to just keep putting the camera in your face and, you know, lessen the impact over time. So it was sort of like, I don't know, it was some kind of psychology going on that we were just trying to figure it out, you know. But after that, then it's like, no, Megan, it's as a performer, you know, she plays with a sort of integrity or a sort of connection to herself and to the music she's playing, in the same way you want an actor to bring themselves and be honest and be kind of fearless. And so she has that dual quality of being shy and being elusive, but also being really brave and being really honest about who she is. And so that works really well, you know, and for an audience, they sort of go, that's me, when they see that.
Do you remember, Megan, the moment where eventually you thought, okay, I'm all right with this now, I can get on with this? Was there a moment where everything changed for you?
I think I found it a lot easier when we were auditioning other characters in the thing, and that kind of helped a lot working, like doing it with someone else. But I don't remember like a particular moment. I knew by the time it was actually came down to the filming, I'd gotten over it all and just got on with it.
I'm going to ask you to play something from the film. So this is Limerick Lasses. Do you want to tell me anything about this before you play it?
Yeah, I play this all the time, but I actually played it for my audition when I went in.
Thank you.
That's Limerick Lasses, played by Megan Nguyenle, who's here in studio along with Lance Daly, the director of Trad. You've got another young actor in this film, Lance, Dallin Woods. Was he as shy as Megan to get on board, or was that an easier process?
No, it was kind of the opposite. We had about 500 self-tapes, you know, from younger. We were looking for a younger brother to play against Megan. And so we were looking for sort of 10, 12 years old who could play a bit of whistle or a bit of baron or something. And Dallin's tape was just the greatest self-tape I've ever seen. He started on a trampoline, introducing himself. And then he had his brother do some editing on it. So did these like side wipes and star wipes to him playing the piano. And then I think he was playing like Pirates of the Caribbean on the piano. And then playing the baron with his brother, playing the whistle. And then playing. And he went through four or five instruments. And then I cut back to him on the trampoline. And he said, that's me. I hope you choose me. I look forward to seeing you soon. And did a backflip to finish it off. So we just saw that and went, okay, there's our guy. And then we got him in with, like Megan said, we got Megan. Once Megan was in, I thought like we just tried to not let her go home. So she was there for all auditioning the other characters and all, you know, because I thought the more she sort of owns the whole film, the better it'll be. So we auditioned everybody against her and meant she got loads of rehearsal time in. But then when Dallin came in, there's just a weird chemistry between them. Megan was like, suddenly she fell in love with him straight away because he's so adorable. But then she just was like his big sister straight away, like the way she was with him. So it was just sort of worked perfectly.
You've got Aidan Gillen in the film as well. He's the head of a bunch of musicians who are all in search of sessions. And then he finds Shona and invites her and her brother to join them. How does that work?
Yeah. How does Aidan join us on this adventure? I think he'd seen a couple of my other films and I'd never met him before this. So I reached out and sat down with him and the character is based on someone I know in real life who people may or may not recognise from About the Place. He's quite eccentric. And when Aidan, as soon as he heard it was based on someone, I think his sort of ears pricked up because he seems to be really interested in what that can be. And fair play to him. Look, it's a small film. And Aidan was just like, I said, I might be doing this for €0. Like, I don't know how this is. And he was like, doesn't matter, I'm in. Just interested in the work. And, you know,
that's what really, you want to hear from an actor like Aidan Gillen.
100%. He's really like the, you know, a true artist and a great collaborator. And then he was with us all the way. I was just looking at when putting together outtakes reel at the moment, just some bloopers and stuff, you know, just to put up on social media. And there's one with Megan's cracking up laughing and we're all around a fire, you know, and then the camera, and she says, I just don't want Aidan to go on fire because Dallin was hitting the fire with a stick. And the camera pans onto Aidan and there's the sparks all over him and he's like sitting in the sand going, oh, I just don't want to set the clothes on fire. But so he was like with us all the way, you know, so it was really good.
I hear that's one of those rules of cinema. Try not to set a lead actor on fire at any stage. That's the thing. Megan, like, music is obviously very much the centre and the heart of this film. And there's a lot of it. There's at firelit beach parties and at busking on the streets. And those sessions, were those the parts of the film that you enjoyed most?
Yeah, probably. I enjoyed it all, really. I think my favourite part was the session at the end. That was the best bit, even though it took us like 3 days to film, but that was the best bit because it really did capture what it's really like.
Was that exhausting in terms of normally you wouldn't be playing pieces of music like that in a setting like that over the course of multiple days? It's quite different from playing a session in a pub.
Yeah, well, I do dance shows as well, so I tour, so it's very much you have to play the same thing every night, like no changes, everything is set. So I was quite used to it, but yeah, it wasn't too hard. Just love the music so much anyways, I don't care how much I have to play it.
And we had really spectacular musicians in playing with us there, Damian Milan and Connor Lyons and Connor Broderick and Eugene Declan Quinn, who did the music for the film. So it was sort of, they all got off on just playing together anyway, you know. And I think that having that caliber of musicians is sort of part of the difference. Part of the conversation was this diddly eye. I mean, the film is talking about it and, you know, what is it? We're doing a preview at the Lighthouse tonight, and sometimes they invent a cocktail for the night, so we're going to ask them to do a diddly eye for it. But so it's a conversation about what that is, and you know, the music that Megan plays and that some of those musicians I just mentioned play are, you know, they're so serious about what the music is, and then there's this tourist postcard, Temple Bar selling of Irish culture and what that is. And sort of the film is a conversation about what should we really care about here and what's really special, you know.
There's probably an element of, it's very hard to quantify what, and I'm using the air quotes around diddly eye music is, but you know it the moment you hear it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. How are you feeling?
I see Owen Colfer is an executive producer on this film, the great Owen Colfer. What was his involvement with this?
Yeah, Owen's one of our great writers, and I've actually written a few things with him that we haven't made yet, and I've been trying to adapt his book Airman to be a movie for many years. So Owen and Patrick O'Neill were our executive producers, and they really came in and helped me figure out how to get the film made. Because it was actually just, but you'd think this would be one that would be, people would be queuing up in terms of the agencies that support this kind of thing would be excited about, but it was actually quite hard to get over the line. And so Owen was there when I needed him most, and Patrick, the two of them just made something possible that would not be here otherwise. So another step for Owen towards National Treasure status, I suppose.
He's had that for a long time, because people will know your name primarily from Black 47. So this was still a tough film to make, even off the back of kind of the reputational heft that you might have from something like that.
Yeah, which I was baffled by. I had a couple of sort of big, ambitious international films that go away for all sorts of reasons, you know, after Black 47. And I wanted to do something here, and I wanted to do this thing about music because I'd been interested for a long time. But yeah, I mean, Black 47 did great box office and seemed like people really responded to it. Like people still, it's, you know, some films get totally forgotten when you do them, and others people keep talking to you about. And it's one of those. So I thought, I thought it'd be easier to get this up and running, but it was trickier, and I can't really speculate as to why that was without complaining. So I'm trying not to complain. We don't have a right to make our films, you know what I mean? So I just got to, so with this one though, I got to a point where I say I can either take no for an answer, or I can decide I'm done asking permission to make films, and if there's something I really want to make, I just have to make it. So there was a bit of that going on, which is why like Aidan, Sarah Gill and Peter Kuhn and everybody coming in to help was like just massive, actually. Just makes, it's all the difference between this whole thing being a transactional, you know, business hustle where we're just making a living churning out content or whatever, and you decide you want to do something personal or something you're interested in, and your fellow collaborators over other projects or who are just in the same field as you say, yeah, this is what we want to be here for, you know. So it's sort of it enlivens the heart a little bit to be supported like that.
Megan, just before we ask you to play one more piece to finish us out, can we expect to see you on the big screen soon, or is this a one and done for you?
I think it's a one and done, yeah. I've done enough. That was a long and great experience, but it was a lot for someone who's never done it before. But I'm just going to stick to my music, I think, and that's it now.
Megan said that to me halfway through the shoot. She said, you know, I'm really enjoying this, but I think this is it for me.
Then maybe you'll play us out with something. You're going to play tribute to Larry Reynolds. What do you want to tell us about this one?
Yeah, it's a reel composed by Morris Lennon. And it's, yeah, a tribute to another fiddle player, Larry Reynolds Sr. Thank you.
that's a tribute to Larry Reynolds, being played by Megan Leguinla. Thanks to writer, director and producer Lance Daly and musician and occasional actor, possibly never again, Megan Leguinla. Trad is in cinemas nationwide from the 8th of May.
Arena on RTE Radio 1.
This is Wednesday night's Arena. In 2 weeks' time, the Festival of Voice returns to the National Concert Hall. This weekend of events celebrates the power, the beauty and universality of the human voice, showcasing Ireland's finest vocal talent alongside world-renowned international artists. The festival features a mix of main stage concerts, intimate performances and interactive workshops. On Saturday, May 23rd, Grammy Award-winning composer and conductor Eric Whittaker, pioneer of the virtual choir, will lead a performance of his signature shimmering harmonies. The audience will be taken on a journey of contemporary choral work performed by the National Symphony Orchestra, the National Symphony Chorus and Chamber Choir Ireland, all under the baton of Eric Whittaker himself, who joins me now. You're very welcome.
Thank you so much. So good to be here.
I'm going to start at the very beginning, Eric. You grew up in a small farming town in northern Nevada. I mean, call me strange, but Nevada doesn't seem to be the first place you would think of when discussing choral music. So how did you end up in this world in the first place?
Yeah, it was a huge accident. Of all things, even in a small farming town, I grew up with synthesizers, and I wanted to be in an 80s pop band. I still do, actually. And when I went to uni in Las Vegas, I joined the choir at 18 years old. I didn't even read music. And the first piece we sang was the Requiem by Mozart, and it utterly changed my life.
You had very little exposure to classical music growing up, as I understand it, but you did. You played around a little bit with that whole aspiration to be a pop star.
Yeah, I mean, I really did. So I had the synthesizers, I had the hair. We were in a band and played festivals and that kind of thing. I really thought that's what I was going to do. I have to admit, I still am obsessed with pop music and synthesis still to this day.
I've seen your TED Talk where you talk about how the only reason you joined the choir was on a whim and possibly not for the most professional of reasons either.
Yeah, I did it to meet girls, I have to say. I should say I'm married to a singer, so maybe that all worked out well.
You've described that choir rehearsal, the very first one, as the moment that your world went from being in black and white to being in color. Maybe take us back to that room and to what exactly happened.
Yeah, So I was standing in a room surrounded by 120 strangers. And, you know, we first start with these warm-ups, la, 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 and back massages. And I've just never been more embarrassed for humanity in my whole life. I had never experienced anything like that. And the conductor stepped up to the podium and he said, let's turn to the Kyrie. I didn't know what a Kyrie was. So I just sort of looked over my shoulder at the guy standing next to me, turned to page 9, and then we launch into this fugue from the Requiem. And it starts with us with the basses. And within 30 seconds, I was just standing in the midst of the more than just the complexity of the music, but just the sheer force of humanity. All of these people united through song. And it changed me forever, that single moment.
Most people, I would presume, think that anybody who ends up becoming a high-level composer, you have to be involved with all of that since childhood. But you didn't learn to read music until you were 18. So I'm kind of interested if you think all of those early years of, you know, unpicking Depeche Mode and Duran Duran songs by ear, if that helped shape the composer you are now.
It's a good question. I'm certain it did. And I think... besides the technical aspect of it, you know, and learning the craft and the skill, which I had a lot of catching up to do, I think in some ways I got lucky not having that background, because I never had this sense that classical music was more refined or more elevated than other kinds of music. Yeah. I find it elevated and refined. But I also find Simon and Garfunkel elevated and refined, or Richard Rodgers or Stevie Wonder. Like, all of these musicians to me are at the highest possible level. And to me, I think Duke Ellington said it best, there's good music and the other kind.
The virtual choir is something I want to talk to you about. It's a global phenomenon these days, but it started with one 17-year-old girl uploading a video to YouTube. So maybe explain that story to us.
Yeah, that's exactly right. This young woman named Britlin Losey uploaded a video singing the soprano line, the top line, to a piece I'd written for a choir called Sleep. And she sent it out into the world like an electronic message in a bottle. And a friend of mine saw it and sent it to me, said, "You've got to see this." And so I watched Britlin's video and I was just struck. This was back in 2009, if you can imagine. And this was before the kind of selfie era. So it was very immediate and kind of visceral, her video. It was just incredibly impactful. And I had this very simple idea, which was if I could get 25 people to do what Britlin was doing, just sing their part and at the same speed and the same key, all I'd have to do is line up all of the videos, just start them all at the same time, and this virtual choir, singers from around the world would emerge. And it worked. The first experiment, the first virtual choir we had 185 singers from 12 different countries. And then we've been making them for, I've got 15 years, and the last one in 2020 during the pandemic had 17,572 singers from 129 different countries.
I want to start off by playing a little piece of this. This is the first song you created the virtual choir with. This isn't the recording of the virtual choir. This is the version from your album Light and Gold, which won the Grammy in 2012. But this is the piece. It's called Lux Aurumque. That brings a little zen and a little calm to your Wednesday evening. That's a piece called Lux Aurumque. Its composer, Eric Whittaker, is still with me. Eric, I'm interested in, since that first experiment with 185 odd singers, and now you deal in thousands, like logistically and artistically, how do you turn thousands of those individual recordings from people all around the world into one single unified sound? It doesn't sound like the easiest job in the world.
Yeah, it takes a team, it takes a village. Although I will tell you, the more people you get, I mean, the basic technical part of it is you try to get the best possible recordings from each person. Although some people send it in on their phones or send it in on small microphones. And then you delicately EQ and make sure all of them are nice and cleaned up before the mix. And then you go for it. But what's incredible is the more people you've got, it's quite like being at a football game where you might have 60,000 people singing and you know that they're not necessarily all sober. And somehow just the massive voices smooths out the rough edges, and it creates this, it kind of gets in your soul, the sound of all of those people singing together. And so you're really benefited by the massive number of voices. I think it's much more difficult to make a virtual choir with, say, 20 singers.
I've listened to the recordings online. They're fairly easy to find, and they're absolutely extraordinary. They're hackles on the back of your neck sort of recordings. I'm interested if you've ever encountered any pushback from, I don't know if you want to call them purists elsewhere in the classical music community, the sort of people who might believe that the only way you can have a choir is have everybody in the same room at the same time.
Yeah, at the very beginning, absolutely. There were people that were pushing back, and it was funny because I think they felt threatened, and they thought that this was somehow trying to replace a live choir, which I would never do. For me, the purest artistic aesthetic there is a cappella voices all singing together in the same room. We've been doing this for thousands of years, and there's nothing like it, not only musically, but in terms of just unifying a group of people. But what has been fascinating is that, so, you know, we were making them, our first one was in 2010, and then in 2020, when the pandemic hit and suddenly people around the world couldn't sing, you know, voices were silenced all at the same time. That's when we realized we'd been practicing for 10 years for this moment, that it became the only way that people could get together and sing. And so, it was funny how it turned eventually to be a necessity.
It's always nice to feel like you've been the innovator in a situation like that. I'm interested in your own composition process, though, because as I understand it, it's remarkably low tech. You only use pencil and paper. You don't use technology.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, unless I'm writing with, I just wrote this big piece with synthesizers and choir, so of course I was using electronics. But I'm just old school that way. And I think part of it just has to do with the physical sensation of the pencil and the paper and seeing and feeling it. And part of it too, I think, is that I spend a lot of time thinking about how the piece will unfold over time. And what I've discovered is that when I'm working on a computer, the monitor is never big enough. I always feel I can only see page to page to page. Mm. And when I write pencil and paper, I can lay them all out on the floor and I can see a piece unfolding across the floor and then have a sense of these long structures.
The program that you're going to be conducting here at the National Concert Hall includes your piece Deep Field. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'm so thrilled to be doing this on that stage. So Deep Field is a tribute to an image that the Hubble telescope took in 1995. And basically they pointed the telescope at a completely dark area of the sky. There was nothing there to earthbound telescopes. And over 11 days, they took 385 separate exposures. And we're just trying to capture anything, the smallest sliver of light. And when the image was finally process, they found what is called the deep field image. You can search this up online. And in this tiny, tiny area of the sky, they found over 10,000 galaxies. 10,000 galaxies, each galaxy representing hundreds of billions of stars. And so I was deeply inspired to write this piece, this tribute to the people who created Hubble, and then also that image itself, which to me just makes me weak in the knees when I see it. It's impossibly grand.
We're going to play a little piece from Earth Choir, which is the final part of Deep Field. This is the part that includes audience participation at the live event. It sounds amazing.
Yeah. It's are you playing?
I'm interested in the process of what you're asking people to do at the event.
It's quite magical. So we after 17 minutes of this orchestral piece and we reach this massive climax, then I turn to the audience and sort of give them the cue, and they've all downloaded this app on their phone beforehand. I talk them all through this, and then they literally just hit play, and then each of the phones has this shimmering electronica sound coming. And when you have thousands of phones in the audience and then the orchestra and choir on stage, it really feels like you're floating in space. It's quite beautiful.
Well, let's have a listen to this. It is Earth Choir from Deep Field. And that's part of Earth Choir from Deep Field by Eric Whittaker, who's still with me on the program. Eric, just maybe to finish, talk to me about how the energy of the room changes when, you know, the audience goes from being passive listener to being active participant in something like that.
That's a beautiful question. Yeah, it's from where I'm at, you know, I'm standing on the podium conducting, so I feel like I'm swimming in the sound, and I think the audience also feels that as well. I feel it's in the best way a unifying event, which is, I have to say, as a composer, what I'm always hoping for, either to write or to experience, this is just a communal event where everyone in the room feels part of something larger than themselves. That for me, I think, is the reason that I was so taken with choral music back when I was 18. And I think it's become sort of the core of my artistic aesthetic. It's the dragon I'll be chasing for the rest of my life.
Eric, it has been absolutely lovely talking to you tonight on the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tickets for Eric Whittaker at the National Concert Hall on Saturday, May 23rd, along with details for the rest of the events at the Festival of Voice, are all available now at nch.ie.
Arena on RTE Radio 1.
Now, the Mojave Desert is a strange place under the searing sun and shimmering heat waves. It's a place both inhospitable and also where Las Vegas has spread its lights. It's where Elysium Nevada, a play by Irish writer Barry McKinley and currently being performed at the Bewley's Cafe Theatre in Dublin, is set. Elysium is a retirement home, and the play is the interplay between three of its residents, all wheelchair-bound and staring out at the vast desert. Joining me now is the director and actor Michael James Ford, who is one of the nursing home trio, along with his fellow actors Mark O'Regan and Barbara Nikriev, and you're all very welcome to Arena.
Thank you.
Bewley's, as a lunchtime theatre venue, you're already up and running. How did today's show go? Who wants to take that? Michael.
It went. We had a great opening today. It was really a lot of fun. The place was absolutely jammed. And yeah, we got terrific response. And they got... The play is... it's a black comedy, but it goes places. And it becomes quite melancholy in... as it develops and as the themes develop, themes of old age, and it touches on dementia. But initially it begins as a pair of cranky boys in the desert giving out about the high school kids who are supposed to be looking after them.
Tell me about Bob and Mike. What sort of men are they when we meet them?
Well, in the reality in Bob's head, he thinks he's an ex-salesman, a top salesman who used to go to Vegas four times a year. And he's in the initial exchange, he's talking to Mike, who's worked one time in Los Alamos.
Yeah, it appears that he worked in the catering division in the Los Alamos project. And he actually says that he had a conversation with Mr. Oppenheimer at one stage. Bob says, like, what would you be talking about? He said, I say, like, have a line, he wasn't happy with the barbecue chicken, you know. So, but the thing about Rick, I suppose, is that it's like an unreliable narrator in a novel. You're not quite sure where the fact is and where the fiction is. It's not Barry sending us off, Barry McKinley sending us off in some kind of into some kind of dark alleyways with it, but because it does actually come together at the end, and if you've worked out little puzzles in the course of it, it's quite a rewarding experience as well, because there are things that he drops, deliberate things like, you know, algebraic equations tattooed on one of the men, and you know, people, I was told this afternoon, they recognised what the algebraic equation was. It had something to do with chain reaction formula. So, you know,
you've got some serious devotees of physics turning up on the very first day.
But it sounded like it today, from what I can gather, yeah.
But all the time we're kind of complaining and arguing and competing, like sort of, you know, middle-aged old American men, who one of whom sees himself as an alpha male. There's this woman who's on an oxygen who we don't seem to know, and that is the character Constance, played by Barbara.
And she's dressed in a very exotic manner. You know, it's like you'd have to come and see it to understand it. Like, costume features feathers, that's all I'll say. But anyway,
seems appropriate for the desert in Nevada.
Absolutely, absolutely. And she loves the desert, but she spends a lot of time asleep on oxygen, you know. So she's quite enigmatic. They don't know anything about her. And one of them's very attracted to her and the other one's kind of afraid of her, really, you know, until she eventually wakes up. And she does wake up.
I mean, as that character, Barbara, who's paying attention to these men, obviously, while they're in the process of having their conversations, they're not really sweet old men, are they? I mean, they engage in quite the banter when they think there's nobody listening.
Oh, absolutely. And very on PC a lot of the time, you know, which is so unusual nowadays, I suppose, to get, you know, in any play or even films now, it's becoming less and less common. But I think also because they think she's asleep all the time, they speak very freely. And Barry McKinley's dialogue is superb. It's full of wicked one-liners, you know.
Well, this seems like the perfect moment to ask you. You're going to do a live excerpt from the play in the form of a radio play, which I'm fairly sure we haven't done in my time here on the programme so far. So, fire ahead.
Can we just say that when this starts, Constance is on oxygen. Okay.
What the hell are you doing?
Why?
You can't go around touching people while they're asleep.
Her hair was in her eyes.
Yeah. And if I was asleep and my hair was in my eyes, I wouldn't be too happy to wake up and find you interfering with me. You know what you are? You're a toucher.
A toucher?
Yeah. You get off on touching people and then acting like it's something innocent.
It is innocent. You've got a filthy mind, do you know that? All I did was take the hair out of the lady's eyes, and you're making it out to be something dirty.
All I'm saying is that you touched somebody who did not express an interest in being touched.
I didn't mind being touched.
Did she say something?
I said I didn't mind being touched.
What?
I haven't been touched like that in years. It was nice. I liked it. Your fingers are soft. The only people who touch me these days are doctors, and their hands are always hard. My name is Constance, by the way.
I'm Mike, and the cranky guy is Bob.
And that's an excerpt from Elysium, Nevada, with Marco Regan, Michael James Ford, and Barbara Nicrieve still here with us in studio. Michael, how do you bring the vastness of the Mojave Desert to the relatively small stage of Bewley's Cafe Theatre? Is it all soundscape? Is it tumbleweed? How does that work?
Well, it's a mixture, really. That we have a wonderful backdrop, which actually is of the Mojave Desert, with a giant cactus in the centre, which is... and various desert things are referenced. And then we have this extraordinary soundscape by the musician Ewan Cowley. So we have sounds of cicada and buzzards, which, of course, is quite important for two old men contemplating death, and coyotes. And then at one stage, there's a spectacular sandstorm where we have, which is... first for Bewley's, we had the first sandstorm on the Bewley stage, and a fan comes into action, and yeah, all sorts of things happened, and the sound goes crazy, and we have a wonderful lighting plot designed by Colin Maher.
And our set designer, of course, is Martin Cahill, who can make magic in any space, no matter what size.
Mark, I'm interested, as actors, the three of you are in wheelchairs, so how does that enhance or restrict your performances?
Good question. I mean, initially when we got into the chairs, we were really kind of new to wheeling ourselves about, but inevitably, when you're doing it over and over again over a 2-week period, we could almost I'd say, compete at Olympic level now for working within the tiny space. And it has already been described as, by somebody today, as like a wheelchair ballet, you know, because we have to maneuver around a very, very short area, confined area. And it's actually now, I mean, the choreography really today was great because we have crashed into each other a little bit during preview, and today we managed to avoid each other. And it was, you know, that in itself was satisfying.
Yeah, there is a moment when it sort of turns into wheelchair dodgems.
There is one moment, yeah.
Michael, you were in Richard Linklater's wonderful film made in Ardmore with Ethan Hawke, Blue Moon, about the life of Lawrence Hart. What was that like to be a part of that?
Oh, that was a great experience. And just lovely atmosphere on set. It was all done. It was just done in 3 weeks. They built Sardi's Italian restaurant out in Ardmore, and it was like a very theatrical piece, very kind of dialogue heavy.
It feels like a stage play, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Really exciting and lovely people to work with. It was very special, and working alongside the likes of Andrew Scott and Stephen Delaney and, of course, Ethan Hawke. It was an absolute blast, and I was delighted then that the film turned out so well.
Mm. And just to get back to the play before I finish, at first it might seem like this ordinary meditation on old age, these two men complaining about how the world has changed and things are different as opposed to what it was in their day, but there's so much more to it than that, isn't there, really?
Could I say one thing? Like, I think when we see plays, and particularly if you see a play that has three people in wheelchairs in a retirement home, usually the play is about disability and is quite maybe, you know, serious, and there's nothing wrong with that. But the thing about this play that Barry McKinley manages to do is he gives you three people and you get a sense of these people have had really interesting lives and very, very different lives, all of them. And you get a sense of that coming through. And in fact, they were linked to one of the biggest events, I suppose, in human history. And there's a twist at the end where you kind of go, oh my God. So it's not a, you know, for all the humour and everything that's in it, there's a hell of a lot in the play.
But it does go, it goes into, you know, the whole area of loss of memory and cognitive disarray. But there's, suddenly you also get the support of the other people, you know, where they're helping each other. And there's a great compassion in the play for all its blackness and dark comedy. And I think it was lovely today that people were moved by it.
In terms of the creation of something like this, a production like this, and putting it on somewhere like Bewley's, what sort of process has gone into that? How many months or how many years has it been to finally get it to this place and to put this particular play on?
Well, it existed. It was done 15 years ago in Bewley's and in the Viking. So really it was a case of, you know, this, we've just felt it was a perfect time to revive this play. So the script was there. Now there were some changes, different ideas came to it. Barry made some lovely changes. But ultimately it was getting three actors and our director, Liam Halligan, into the room and reinvestigating it. And it was really, it's been a great and very exciting process.
It has been wonderful to talk to all three of you tonight. Michael James Ford, Barbara Nicrieve and Mark O'Regan. Thanks so much for joining me tonight on Arena.
Thank you.
Elysium Nevada runs at Bewley's Cafe Theatre until the 30th of May, Monday to Saturday at 1. And there's also a soiree show at 7 o'clock on Saturday, May 16th. More details at Bewley'sCafeTheatre.com. Tomorrow night on the programme, we're looking at the week's new film, including the traditional music drama Trad we talked about earlier, Hugh Jackman and a stellar voice cast in The Sheep Detectives, and Japan's highest ever grossing live action film, Kokuo. We'll have Ham Sandwich playing live in studio, and after her recent win at the BAFTA TV Craft Awards, Una Nikonila will be talking to us about the art of editing. That's tomorrow night from 7. Tonight's programme, produced by Reg Luby, Mary Elizabeth Bruton was the broadcast coordinator, Ollie Hamilton's our researcher, and it was Cara O'Hare on sound tonight. John Creedon is next. I will talk to you tomorrow.